From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Hours before the start of the NATO bombing, journalist Anthony Lloyd had to get out of Kosovo in a hurry because the Serbs had accused him of being a spy. Lloyd is a foreign correspondent for the Times of London and has covered the Balkans for 4.5 years. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Lloyd about his escape and his impressions of the Kosovo Liberation Army and the Serb military. Also today, we talk with the CIA's chief spokesperson, Bill Harlow. He's written a new thriller in which Libya is planning a chemical attack against the United States. And the hero of the book, the White House press secretary, has to spin the story. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hours before the start of the NATO bombing of Serbia, journalist Anthony Lloyd had to get out of Kosovo in a hurry. Serb police and security forces were looking for him. He was accused of being a spy. And a Serb extremist group had put out a death warrant on him. Lloyd is a foreign correspondent for the Times of London and has covered the Balkans for 4.5 years. He's in London now, where he'll stay for a few more days before returning to the Balkans to cover the war. Earlier today, he spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. We talked about his escape from Kosovo, as well as his impressions of the Kosovo Liberation Army and the Serbian Army. I asked him if he knew why he was accused of being a spy.
I've been in Kosovo for a long time this year, 2.5 months in the run-up to the NATO airstrikes. And I'd done a lot of work out in the field, often with the KLA, often in areas of fighting. It is possible that the Serbs accused me of being a spy just because they didn't like what I was writing and didn't want me to return to Kosovo. It is also possible that they genuinely believed I was a spy because by the nature of my job, I have to speak to many people, and some of those were NATO sources, NATO contacts. I did used to be in the British Army. The Serbs alleged that I was working for British military intelligence, and that was why they were after me, but I don't know the answer.
What was your plan to get out?
Initially, my plan wasn't to get out. My plan was to go over to an area of territory still held by the KLA and to sit out with what followed with them. Unfortunately, it didn't work quite as easily as that. The morning of the day of the airstrikes, the 24th of March, the police arrived at the small guest house in which I was staying at 4 o'clock in the morning. The guy who ran that guest house, who was a Serb but is a friend of mine, told them I'd already gone. Shortly after dawn, myself and Kurt Schork, who's a journalist from Reuters and a colleague and friend, loaded up a Land Rover with all our belongings, what we needed to stay in the field, and drove out westwards to a KLA zone. We were unlucky in that the first thing we drove into was a large ambush laid by the KLA for Serbian forces. They didn't shoot at us. They detained us for a while. We talked our way through that position, but they didn't want us to stay around, and they wouldn't let us go any further on. So we turned back towards Pristina. On our way back, we got a phone call from a friend, another colleague inside Pristina, warning us not to return. That the police had come around again and were after us. We turned back one more time to the KLA lines, but this time a Serb checkpoint had sprung up in our path, manned by special police in balaclavas. They wouldn't let us pass. We would turn back to Pristina again. We were getting more phone calls, don't come back. We had to go back to drop off a vehicle and pick up another vehicle to make good our escape, as it became apparent to us by that time it was necessary to leave. We arrived back at the hotel. The guy who owned it, or the guest house, the guy who owned it, who is our sort of protector, was in tears by that stage and was saying that he couldn't protect us anymore. The police were after us. We had to get out of town and get out of town right then. And that we did. It was not easy. That morning and throughout that day, the 24th, there were swarms of military and police reinforcements entering Pristina, going through apartment blocks, setting up checkpoints. So we took the road going eastwards into Serbia proper and then crossed into Macedonia at just before dusk that day.
What kind of preparations for war were you seeing as you tried to get out?
There had been a noticeable escalation in the tension throughout the whole province for at least 3 weeks before. This year, right from the start of the year, it's become more and more unstable. The fighting's got worse. Even in Pristina, which used to be comparatively relaxed until recently because it was quite a rural war in Kosovo, and Pristina, the capital, seemed exempt from that. In the month running up to the airstrikes, there would be no one on the streets after 6 p.m. in the evening, just police, soldiers. Then in the last 4 days, you saw many, many more soldiers coming into the province, columns of tanks, APCs, trucks. The Serbian civilians in Kosovo seem to be more mobile too, moving around in trucks, armed. There seem to be many more police and a lot more tension.
You got to Macedonia, to the border, a couple of hours, I think, before the NATO bombing began. Did you see a lot of ethnic Albanians trying to flee before the bombs hit and before the Serbs escalated their attack?
No. At the border crossing point we got to, just north of the Macedonian town of Kumanovo, there were perhaps a few hundred Albanians who were trying to leave. Already at that stage, they were in a very distressed state. They were getting harassed both by Serb border guards and the Macedonian border guards. What we saw more of was roads being dug up by Serb troops in preparation for detonation charges to be laid, to be blown in the case of NATO troops trying to come in over land. Bridges having charges laid beneath them, armoured personnel carriers moving up onto hillsides, anti-aircraft guns taking up position on the tops of hills, tanks moving through fields, and lots of reinforcements, infantry reinforcements coming in.
How did you feel as a journalist having to leave the country right before the war? I think you were hoping to be able to observe from a distance the NATO bombing, to be able to report on it. What are the things that you had to weigh in terms of, like, the assignment and saving your life?
Kurt and I were definitely prepared to stick it out with the KLA for as long as was necessary, which I guess we were prepared to stay out with them for a very long time. When it became apparent that we were being actively pursued by the forces of the Yugoslav state, the police and military, actively and personally pursued, and that we could not reach the KLA areas, then pretty well instantaneously it became obvious to us that it was a question of survival. It was necessary to get out. The morning after we'd got out, the morning of the 25th, was a pretty bleak morning, personally speaking. We'd both been in Kosovo on this assignment for over 2.5 months. We were right into the rhythm of the story. We were very well connected on the Albanian side, quite well connected on the Serbian side. We'd been working with interpreters and fixers, local Albanians in Pristina, who we'd had to abandon at very, very short notice. At the stage when we got out, most other representatives of the media, journalists, TV reporters and producers, were still in. They got kicked out about 24 hours later. So our vision on the 25th of March was pretty bad. We were the only ones at that stage who had had to get out or face arrest or worse. We left a lot of good people behind us, and we felt pretty bad. Also, it was a very severe exit. We didn't expect to have to get out of the country that fast. And while we did feel relief at having escaped, that was tempered with a great deal of disorientation. No, we weren't in that good a shape the next day.
My guest is Anthony Lloyd, and he's been covering the Balkans for the Times of London for 4.5 years. You spend time covering the Kosovo Liberation Army. How close were you able to get to people in the KLA?
Pretty close, especially in the field and in areas of fighting. They were relatively hospitable in their attitude and treatment of members of the press, particularly Americans and British, and they regarded both America and Britain as allies. The KLA this year divided Kosovo up into 7 operational zones. We met most of the 7 operational zone commanders, and they were by and large articulate, frank, and direct with us. And in terms of the fighting, if you're on the KLA side, you could go as far as you wanted to on the front line.
What was the ultimate goal of the KLA? Or what is the ultimate goal of the KLA?
The ultimate goal of the KLA is to gain independence for Kosovo.
And what were your impressions of the tactics that the KLA was using?
The KLA have changed quite a lot in the year and a half, or slightly less than a year and a half, since they've been fighting the Serbs. Originally, they started off as a very small group. This, we're talking January, February last year. They were so small that actually in urban areas in Kosovo, people weren't sure if they were just a myth. Until right at the end of February last year, there was a gun battle between a small group of KLA and some Serb police in the Drenica area of central Kosovo. The war started in Kosovo then, on the 28th of February last year. very soon the KLA had lots and lots of fresh recruits, young guys who were felt very embittered by their treatment at the hands of the Yugoslav regime. They got a lot of weapons in, most of them smuggled over the border from Albania. But in terms of their preparation for the war, they were pretty inept. They had a few trained soldiers, guys who had served time in foreign armies abroad, French Foreign Legion, some of them as well in the British Army and French Army, if they had dual nationality. Those veterans came back and tried to train up the new volunteers. But by the time of the summer offensives last year, they still hadn't got much clue militarily. And in the face of Serb armored assaults and infantry assaults, they just melted away. In the intervening period since the end of summer last year and this year, they retrained, rearmed, they got a lot of new weapons in. The new weapons brought almost entirely, but not exclusively, from Serb mafia groups inside Serbia itself. Their training progressed to, I guess, quite a good level of infantry and guerrilla tactic skills. However, it certainly wasn't enough, even by their own acknowledgement, to hold off the Serbs in any concentrated attack. They were always underarmed in spite of the new weapons, and they were no match for Serb forces moving in armored personnel carriers with tanks, with artillery backup, and on occasion helicopter and ground attack aircraft too.
My guest is Anthony Lloyd, a foreign correspondent for the Times of London. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Anthony Lloyd. For the past 4.5 years, he's covered the Balkans for the Times of London. He had to leave Kosovo about a couple of weeks ago when he found out that there was a Serb death warrant on him. Now, I think President Milosevic has tried to characterize the Kosovo Liberation Army as a group of terrorists. Did any of their tactics qualify them for the description of terrorism?
On occasion, the KLA or people in KLA uniform have undoubtedly done bad things. Last year, there seemed to be a fairly systematic trend of abduction of off-duty police officers, off-duty soldiers, and some Serb civilians. Several hundred were taken, and undoubtedly, several score of these hostages were executed. How much of that was pertinent to the KLA's war effort, and how much of that was either criminal activity with an overlap to war activity, or the settling of old scores in a land where vengeance and retribution are very much part of local culture and tradition, I don't know. But without doubt, some of those hostages were killed by people in KLA uniform. However, that does not detract from the fact that the majority of KLA are Kosovar Albanians who have fought a war according to the rulebook, and They are not, in general terms, a group that operates using terror as a means to affect its ends.
You said that their weapons got better over time. Where do they get the weapons from?
As I said, in the initial period, they got a lot of weapons from Albania. Albania is a nation we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years whose army has all but disintegrated and has a glut of weapons on the arms market, mostly Chinese-made weaponry. A lot of that came across the border to arm the KLA last year and still continued to right up until the current fighting at the beginning of this March. However, in the break between the Serb summer offensive last year and today, the KLA chose to arm themselves by dealing with Serb mafia groups inside Serbia who had in turn access both to Yugoslav army weapon stocks and to Eastern European weapon stocks.
My impression was, just, you know, from what I've read and heard from reporters, that early on when the KLA formed and it had some victories and gained control over parts of Kosovo, they maybe became too overconfident and thought that winning would be pretty easy and weren't quite prepared for what was really ahead. Is that your impression?
I think the KLA have always been aware that they cannot match the speed, the mobility, and the firepower of the Yugoslav army inside the province. I think it's not accurate to talk about KLA victories last year. At one point, they did end up holding over 45% of the territory, but that was not territory that they had seized in combat and then held. That was territory which was, by and large, rural hinterland, which was always traditionally Albanian, where it was very rare to see police, army, or military patrols. And as the KLA emerged and armed themselves, they held it sort of by the nature of being there. This was not ground that was taken in action. I do not think were aware of the preparations last year the Serbs were undertaking for the summer offensive. And when that occurred, certainly the KLA just melted or were blown away before it. This year, having had that experience, they were more aware of what could happen to them. And as many of them mentioned, they said the Serbs could do the same to us this year as they did last year. But it would be more difficult for them because of the nature of the KLA now having mortars and anti-tank systems. However, they were aware that the same thing could happen, and if the Serbs put their mind to it, that they, the KLA, would not be able to defend their civilian population.
I know it's been a couple of weeks since you've been in Kosovo, but what do you think is left of the Kosovo Liberation Army now?
Not very much. I'm in contact with people who are in touch with the KLA inside Kosovo. There are still isolated bands of KLA operating as partisan guerrilla units. But in terms of their command and control structure, that's been severely damaged by the current Serb offensive. They've had tremendous difficulties in trying to get ammunition to their guys across the border, across the Albanian border. The units that are left existing inside Kosovo are desperately short of ammunition. The Serbs have widened their free fire zone along the Kosovo-Albanian border to a depth of 15 kilometers from what was 5 kilometers. And scores of KLA troops have been killed in recent days trying to get ammunition in from Albania to Kosovo. Doubtless, the Serbs will fail if they are wishing and aiming to totally eradicate the KLA. The KLA are now a very populist movement, and even if they are broken in the short term, in the medium and long term, they will reemerge. But there's no doubt about it. In the short term, they're doing very poorly inside Kosovo. They've lost a lot of people. And as a large-scale unit, they've been broken up, fragmented into small guerrilla groups.
Did you spend time with the Serbian military?
As a foreigner, as a foreign journalist, the Serbs are a lot more difficult to work with. With the experience that they had of dealing with foreign media and foreign powers in Bosnia, they regarded us, by and large, as hostile entities right from the word go, and they didn't want us to accompany them on their operations. On occasion, it would be possible to work with Serb units in the field as a foreigner, but those occasions were very few and very with large gaps between.
From the little that you were able to see close up of the Serb army, did you get an impression whether most of the people in the army were there because they wanted to be or because they were forced to be?
The majority of the Serb army forces in Kosovo are conscripts. Some of those conscripts are happy enough to be there. Some are very unhappy to be there. The myth of Kosovo being a crucible and heartland to Serb culture and civilization can be shown up for what it is by the fact that most of the Serb soldiers in Kosovo from Serbia proper had never visited the province before they were sent there as soldiers and had little desire to shed their blood for it now. That said, however, the Yugoslav army did have some extremely professional, regular units present in the province, the Serb anti-terrorist police and special police as well. Pretty tough guys, pretty well armed and pretty well motivated.
Milosevic wants to keep control over Kosovo. Kosovo wants to break away and become independent. People in Kosovo have been living under martial law for several years. What are your impressions of the legitimacy of both sides?
I think it's a good question. I think it's an issue we see time and time again in our contemporary life in the West. We see a country that has an area of ground which is historically belongs to that particular country, but by the nature of demographic changes, happens to be populated by different people who have their own claim to independence. I think that Milosevic, though he had a genuine claim to Kosovo being part of Serbia, province of Serbia, a claim that was recognized by the West, who in their peace efforts wanted only to secure Kosovo autonomy rather than independence, I think in spite of that, he has given up his right and his credibility for any future hold on Kosovo by the way he's conducted the war against the Albanian civilian population, both last year and this year, particularly with the precedent and experience of the wars he's fought in Bosnia, Croatia, and Slovenia before, which are characterized by the Yugoslav army and paramilitary forces conducting campaigns that involve massive abuses of human rights and large-scale, whole-scale looting and slaughter.
Anthony Lloyd is a foreign correspondent for The Times of London. Our interview was recorded this morning. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By Antioch University, a place for writers. On the web at www.antioch.edu. Or 937-767-6494. And by Random House, publishers of Little Green Men by Christopher Buckley. The truth is out there, way out there. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with journalist Anthony Lloyd, who was in Kosovo covering the KLA until hours before the NATO bombing. And the CIA's chief spokesman, Bill Harlow, tells us about his new thriller. The hero is the White House press secretary. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our conversation with Anthony Lloyd. He's a foreign correspondent for The Times of London and has covered the Balkans for 4.5 years. He had been in Kosovo for 2.5 months when he learned that the Serbs had accused him of being a spy and had issued a death warrant. He escaped from Kosovo March 24th. Earlier today, he spoke to us from London, where he intends to stay for a few more days before returning to the Balkans. The systemized way in which the Serbs drove out the ethnic Albanians from Kosovo indicates that they had some kind of scheme in place for a while because it was so well organized. I think you actually observed this kind of thing happening at small villages months ago. Not in the same proportions as we've seen it in the past few weeks, but basically the same system.
Yeah, the system was quite simple. This was something I saw last summer as well as earlier this year. And let's not forget, last summer there was 300,000 ethnic Albanian civilians who were driven or burnt out of their homes by a Serb military offensive, which ended on October the 13th when U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrook secured a deal with Milosevic, a ceasefire deal then. Then, as now, the tactics were very familiar. Serb army would move up onto high ground overlooking Albanian villages or towns, begin shelling the residential areas. The civilians would flee. Then Serb infantry would close in to the village or hamlet or town, whatever. The KLA might stand and resist a little, but probably not. The KLA then would run, the infantry would go in and burn down the village. And this year, the crucial date seemed to be sort of the 18th of March, when in the second round of Paris peace talks, the Albanians signed up, the Serb delegation didn't. 2 days later, the KVM, that's Kosovo Verification Mission, monitors who were sent in by Richard Holbrooke, or to police the deal, the ceasefire deal made by Richard Holbrooke last October, they left. They left Kosovo on the 20th of March this year, 2 days after the Albanians signed that agreement, because they realized the Serbs were building up their forces in the region and that they could potentially come hostages, international hostages, in the case of any NATO airstrikes. That very same day they left, the Serbs went into a town called Srbica. This was a town of originally 10,000 people, the majority of them Albanians. The population had been swollen to about 17,000 by refugees coming in from other areas over the previous few weeks. It was controlled by Serbian police, the town, but it had never been the scene of fighting. However, on this day, the same day as KVM monitors were leaving, the Serbs sent in guys in white jumpsuits with black face masks and balaclavas, and they, as it's called in Europe, ethnically cleansed, which basically means purge the town of its population, by going from house to house, ordering people out of their houses on pain of death, ordering people out of their homes, shooting some guys in the street, young men of military age who they found. And these were the tactics similar to those used in Bosnia to deprive Muslims of their homes in Bosnia during the Bosnian War that personally I hadn't seen in Kosovo before.
As a journalist, have you ever really wanted to talk to some of the Serbs who are actually knocking on doors and threatening people with their lives and, you know, purging whole villages and say to them, how can you do this? I mean, is that an impulse to just ask a naive question like that?
Terry, it's not so much of an impulse to ask a naive question like that when you see guys in black balaclavas kicking in front doors and shooting people in the streets. No, but I have asked Serbs many times in less dramatic circumstances why they do what they do. The answer usually bears no relation to reality at all. The answer is usually steeped in rather twisted historical values, whereby they talk about Islamic threat to Serbian people and how if they don't kick the Albanians out of their homes, then the children of the Albanians will grow up into Mujahideen who will terrorize the local Serbs, or this, that, or the other. Basically, they talk the propaganda of their nation, and there is no reasonable or rational or logical answer in defense of their actions.
And is that propaganda information that they're getting in the military or just on TV and radio and in the press as well?
No, they're very much given it. They're fed it in the military too. Undoubtedly, there are a few bright people who see the lie in the information they're being given. But also, let's not forget, Yugoslavia is a country that has been involved in one war or another since 1991. So the people are, by the nature of their experience over these 8 years, tense and susceptible to fear caused by rumors and propaganda anyway. And with the Serbs, there is some kind of national psychosis, might be too strong a word. They suffered very, very grievously in the Second World War at the hands of both the Croat fascist regime that was a puppet state of Germany and German forces and Italian forces, and even in the final analysis, Russian forces who invaded at the end of the war, they are no stranger to local enemies. And that's the Serbian civilian population did lose a lot of people in terrible circumstances in the Second World War. With that legacy, the legacy of that history, it is very easy to reincarnate similar fears in a modern-day population using the tactics of propaganda.
So when do you plan on going back to the region, and what do you hope to cover when you get there?
Terry, I hope to go back next week. First of all, to go to Macedonia, see what the situation is along the border there, speak to some of the NATO commanders on the ground there, then go on down to Tirana, the capital of Albania, speak to some KLA officers who are hanging around in that area, before going north to northern Albania along the border with Kosovo. It's a very high mountain range. You can look into Kosovo very easily on a clear day. And speak to some of the refugees who have come across in the previous couple of weeks. I've got people who I had to leave behind in Kosovo who I'd be interested, very interested to see or hear any news of from any of those people who might know of them. And my sense and my hunch is that unless Milosevic gives up in the face of the Western demands, pulls out all his troops from Kosovo and allows all the refugees to return voluntarily, something which I don't think he's prepared to do, there is going to be a large ground war. And obviously, as a journalist, then I want to be involved in covering that war.
When you say ground war, do you mean including NATO troops?
Yeah, I mean including NATO troops. I mean a NATO ground force going in over the border and securing Kosovo as a protectorate for the Albanian refugees to return.
Do you have reasons to believe that the Serbian army is preparing for a ground war?
Yeah, I know for sure that Serbian army is preparing for a ground war just by the nature of what I saw as I left Kosovo, which is, as I say, were roads being dug up with mountain roads being dug up, detonation charges laid beneath and around them, so those could be blown in the event of any NATO armored columns pushing northwards, bridges being wired in a similar way, and the number of reinforcements that were being flooded into the country, not only to deal with, as the Serbs say, the KLA, but also purge the Albanian civilian population, but also dig defensive fortifications in preparation to defend Kosovo against a NATO ground invasion.
I imagine that the Serb death warrant on your life is still out there. Are there special precautions you're going to have to take when you return to the region?
Yeah, the death warrant, I don't know if that was devolved from the efforts of the Serb police to get me or not. I got a warning about 3 weeks before, 2 weeks before perhaps I left Kosovo, so we're talking a month ago, which came from a British Foreign Office source via the Times to me in Kosovo, saying that there was an ultra-nationalist Serbian group in Mitrovica, which is a Kosovan town, who had a price on my head. Now, I don't know if these guys were involved with the police who also wanted part of it or not. But all I do know is that when I return to Kosovo, I'm going to be returning with NATO troops. And it would not be in my interest to return as a lone entity while the Serbs still control that province, because my fate would not be an enviable one.
Well, I wish you good luck, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you.
Anthony Lloyd is a foreign correspondent for the Times of London. Our interview was recorded this morning. Coming up, the CIA's chief spokesperson discusses his new thriller. This is Fresh Air. You wouldn't expect the hero of a political military thriller to be a White House press secretary. But it's not surprising when the author of the thriller is a former assistant White House press secretary for national security and foreign affairs. In fact, the author, Bill Harlow, is now the CIA's director of public affairs. His new novel is called Circle William. The title comes from the naval warning to prepare for chemical, biological, or nuclear attack. In the novel, U.S. officials learn that Libya is preparing to launch a secret chemical attack against the U.S. The White House press secretary and his brother, the naval commander of a new high-tech ship, have to prevent panic and try to stop the attack. It's certainly a busy week for Bill Harlow, but he was able to take a few minutes to talk with us. The naval commander in your novel misreads one of the reporters. And he's, you know, he does this interview with the reporter, and he's thinking, good thing I talked to that reporter personally. I think she really came around. I walked away from that session feeling really good. Well, it turns out that's not what happened at all. And the article is a public relations nightmare for the Navy. And I'm wondering if that's ever happened to you, if you've totally misjudged a reporter and an article comes out, you know, just really slamming the CIA or slamming, you know, the military when you work for the military.
I don't think I've ever misjudged one quite as badly as he does in the book, but it's not uncommon for people who don't deal with the media very often to see things in a different light, to not understand some of the impact of the language they're using, or to believe that they're being more persuasive than they might actually be. Those of us that deal with the media on a regular basis, who understand the nuances and the media's agenda and requirements and needs, I think have a bit more realistic viewpoint of how the interviews go. And you also never get carried away with your expectations. And the finest interview that you ever do, or background or whatever, you don't let yourself get carried away with the expectation that it's going to be a real puff piece, because experience has shown that very often they're not.
The reporter in your novel is criticized for not understanding military culture. She's covering a big Navy story. And, you know, the press secretary says to her, did you have any friends at all who were ever in the military? Do you know anything about the military culture? What are your biggest criticisms of the press?
Well, that is one that increasingly you find people covering the military, covering defense, who don't know much about it. Back 15, 20, 30 years ago, most of the reporters covering defense were people who themselves had served in the military. They certainly knew plenty of people who had been in the military, and they had a context to put it in. As we've gone to the all-volunteer force, and many people have not had the opportunity to serve, have not lived around military bases, they just don't understand the culture. For the people who cover the Pentagon full-time, they quickly get up to speed, and the military takes care to get them out to see hardware, to touch and feel ships and planes and tanks, and so they understand what they're talking about. When there's a crisis going on, whether it's the current crisis in Kosovo or the Gulf War, very often reporters get tossed into a story where last week they were covering traffic accidents, and this week they're covering the war, and you often see misperceptions or misunderstandings of the military, either culture, hardware, techniques. And that causes for some of the less than stellar reporting that you occasionally see.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Harlow. His new novel is called Circle William. Bill Harlow is the director of public affairs for the CIA. What are some of the specific challenges you're facing now as director of public affairs for the CIA, as you're getting questions about the bombing of Serbia?
I'd rather not get into that. Not that I couldn't answer it in another setting, but I just don't want to mix too much my sort of avocation and my vocation. I wouldn't want listeners to get the impression that I'm using my public position to sell books. So if you don't mind, we could sort of not do that question.
Yeah, no, well that's fine. But that leads me to wonder if, is it hard for you to have a kind of dual life now, one as a novelist and the other as CIA spokesperson?
It's not the easiest thing in the world. One of the things that you need to understand is that I wrote the book before I came to the CIA. I completed it during my last year of active duty in the Navy. I spent 25 years as a naval officer. And so while there are CIA things in the book, the CIA does not figure too largely in the book. The Navy and the press secretary are really the heroes of the book. So now, as people know that I'm the spokesman for the CIA, they tend to wonder, well, why isn't the CIA more central to it? Why isn't the CIA all that heroic? And the answer is I wrote it before I got to the agency. That perhaps if I do another book sometime, you know, the agency will be more amply reflected in that book. But this one was done in my spare time, in my last capacity. And now that the book is out, I take vacation time, a day here, a day there, or an hour here, an hour there, to go out and promote it. And I work carefully with the ethics lawyers at the agency to make sure that I don't do anything which crosses the bounds, so that I'm not inappropriately mixing my avocation with my vocation.
What are some of those lines that you're trying not to cross?
Well, I don't use my CIA role to get attention for the book, or I try to make sure that the publisher did not publicize it as CIA spokesman's novel.
No, in fact, under your name on the cover, it says Bill Harlow, Captain, United States Navy, parentheses, retired.
Right.
Doesn't even mention the CIA.
That's right. Somewhere in the back flap, very small print, it might mention what I'm currently doing, but we've gone out of our way not to highlight that, because I don't want inappropriately use the job. On the other hand, I you know, freely admit what I do. I'm the most overt employee of a fairly secretive organization, so I can't deny where I work. But this is definitely something that I do as my avocation, and something that I do on my own time.
Does keeping secrets come pretty naturally to you?
No comment. No. I understand the need for securing some information that were to get out inappropriately, it could cause damage to national security. But generally, I think I'm a reasonably open person. I try to find ways to convey what information we can, so that if you're in the Navy and somebody asks you a question about a ship or a weapon system and you can't tell them exactly what they want to know, there's probably something else you can tell them that approximates that gets them where they want to go, and you don't have to give them the exact targets that carrier aircraft are aiming at, or the time that a ship will sail. But you can give them enough information to answer their needs and to convey the message you want to convey without doing any damage to national security. It's a challenge, but that's what makes it fun.
My guest is Bill Harlow, Director of Public Affairs for the CIA. He's written a new thriller called Circle William. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is the CIA's chief spokesperson, Bill Harlow. He's written a new political military thriller called Circle William. In the book, the White House press secretary doesn't like the Secretary of State, and one day when the Secretary of State is making a speech, the press secretary mutters to himself, "What a windbag," not realizing that there's an open mic from C-SPAN just a few feet away, and so his comments are actually picked up by television and end up making front page headlines. Now, that's a gaffe that kind of happened to Ronald Reagan when he didn't know a mic was on and he said, "When do we start bombing?" I'm wondering about some of the gaffes that you've made that you might want to share with us.
I haven't had as many opportunities for live microphones as presidents and presidential press secretaries have. So I haven't had anything quite that colorful. I have said some things to print reporters which, when strung together, have appeared harsher in print than they should be. I recall, as a young Navy spokesman on the news desk in the Pentagon for the Navy, I was asked a question about President Carter's plans to sell the presidential yacht Sequoia, and I was just trying to say, well, he's the president, of course, you know, whatever he wants to do is okay with us. But the way it came out, it sounded like, well, he's the commander-in-chief, and he can do anything he wants, no matter how foolish, said Navy spokesman Bill Harlow, which didn't go over real well with the White House at the time. But I managed to survive that. My career survived it. And I think people who deal with the press on a regular basis know that it's not a 100% foolproof business, and from time to time you're going to make a mistake, and hopefully your boss understands that as well.
So how did you handle that? Did you point the finger at the reporter and say, look, this isn't what I said, I was just misinterpreted, or did you apologize?
A little bit of both. I was summoned to my boss's office and several other bosses' office to explain what I meant and what I had to say, and I think that was early in the administration, and I think they when they recognized that was a reasonably young, inexperienced spokesman, they just sort of laughed it off. So I managed to live to respond another day.
Is there a classic spokesperson gaffe that you've been taught to avoid? The kind of textbook case that when you were coming up, you were taught about?
Well, there. I guess probably the biggest thing that you're told is don't respond to hypothetical questions. Well, what would you do if?
Mm-hmm.
Because it just gets you down a road that you don't want to go. It's tough enough to answer the questions about what has happened or what you are definitely going to do, and you just don't want to get yourself in trouble by speculating what might happen based on things that you have no control over. The other thing is that sometimes people can get too colorful. In an effort to be responsive, to be humorous, if you can make some comments or statements that in cold type look a bit harsh. My old boss, Marlon Fitzwater, in his book about his days in the White House, Call the Briefing is the title of his book, and he talks about how he decided to respond to some of Gorbachev's initiatives by referring to him as a drugstore cowboy. And once he did that, there was a big flurry and a storm of protest, and he certainly didn't mean to cause an international incident, but I'm sure that he immediately after saying that wished that he had used language that was a bit less colorful.
So sometimes it's better to be dull than colorful.
I've made a career out of being dull.
Well, but you can't do that when you're writing a novel.
That is a challenge. That is a challenge, but I think what I hope that the novel shows is that it gives people an understanding about how things actually are. You know, there are a lot of novels that are written based on the White House as a setting, or the Pentagon, or Navy ships. And what makes this one a little bit different, I think, is that the author, in this case me, I've had an opportunity to work in all those places. So I'm not really making it up. I'm not inventing the way things are there. I pretty well know how people interact with each other. And so I try to convey that with a sense of realism that I hope comes through in the book.
No, I read in a press item that the White House press secretary Jill Lockhart called to say that the president liked your novel, and then you told the press about that. And I can't help but wonder if this was, you know, a little arranged. You know what I mean? If Joe Lockhart like knows you, if you're kind of like press secretary buddy types, and he wanted to do you a favor and everything.
That's not entirely accurate description of what happened, but a friend of mine turns out apparently is a friend of some people at the White House, and mm-hmm. this friend of mine read the book and liked it. And he knew that the president likes this kind of book, and he sent him a copy of it for him to read at some point. It turned out that as the president was flying back from King Hussein's funeral on Air Force One, he was reading the book. And when he finished the book, he took it back and was going to give it to Joe Lockhart, because one of the heroes of the book is a press secretary, and he thought Joe might find that interesting and enjoyable, since press secretaries aren't often depicted as heroes. And turned out Joe was sleeping on the plane, so he just left it for him with a note. A day or two later, Joe called my office to let me know that, and I happened not to be there that day, and he told some members of my staff I was having a book party the next day, and they were chatting to people at the book party, including some people in the media, so word got out that way. But it wasn't a setup, although I have no complaints about the fact that word got out that, that President Clinton enjoyed the book. And in fact, the president wrote a little note in the copy and sent it back to me. And the book, I've also sent a copy to my old boss, President Bush, and I understand President Carter has also read it. So I'm doing pretty well with the president, the next president market.
Yeah, right. Well, Bill Harlow, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Bill Harlow is the CIA's Director of Public Affairs. His new novel is called Circle William. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Monique Nazareth, with Alan Tu and Anne-Marie Baldonado. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close today's show with a recording by Red Norvo, who died Tuesday at the age of 91. He started his career playing xylophone and went on to become one of the first great jazz vibraphonists. He made his first recordings in the 20s, but for decades he kept up with modern music. We'll hear a 1950 session featuring a trio he led with guitarist Tal Farlow and bass player Charles Mingus. This is Move.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Serta, maker of the Serta Perfect Sleeper Mattress, helping generations of Americans to sleep since 1931. And from Little Brown & Company, publishers of All Too Human, a political education by George Stephanopoulos, in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Jerry Mulligan is the subject of a new permanent exhibition at the Library of Congress. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we listen back to a 1989 interview with the late baritone saxophonist and arranger. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.